Welcome to the Journey to Midwifery podcast. This is a podcast for and about midwives. This is the place where midwives come to share their stories. I am your host, Amber Wilson, a midwife myself. I felt called to this journey of sharing the stories of midwives around the globe, and I hope you will find as much joy listening as I do interviewing. Remember, life is about the journey.
All right. Hello, Carol. Welcome to this podcast. I'm really excited that we finally connected. And I get to hear your story, as I said, offline very organically because we haven't met before and I don't know much of your story. So you get to share with me just as the listeners will hear. So start with an introduction. Tell me who you are.
My name is Carol Leonard and I'm a retired midwife, direct entry midwife, I guess is what we used to call it back in the day. And I live in Ellsworth, Maine, but my practice was in New Hampshire. And I was the first midwife licensed to practice legally in the state of New Hampshire. When I became a midwife in 1975, there were no midwives in New Hampshire. So I was actually trained by an old country doctor. And that was really an incredible experience. And I think I did probably 100, 150 births with Dr. Brown. And then I ended up delivering about 1,200 babies at home and in New Hampshire and in Moscow. I went to Moscow and when it was still the Soviet Union, delivered babies there. I was supposedly the first American to deliver a Ruski baby in 1990. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. That's trajectory. Exciting.
Yes, your name was given to me on social media because I said, hey, I need midwives from different states. And I had your name come up. So you are obviously known and well-loved. So
I wrote a book about my experiences. I can plug it. It's called Lady Anne's Lion's Heart, A Midwife Saga. I finished writing it in 1995, but I didn't publish it until 2010, but you can get it on Amazon. It's a memoir of my, you know, my midwifery profession. It's a great book. I'm going to read from it in a little while.
Yeah. And so we'll get a little brief snippet of your story here that people mm-hmm. can read about more thoroughly on your book. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So my first starting question is always, what brought you to midwifery? What made you come to this calling?
Well, I always intended to be a veterinarian. And then I had my first baby when I was 24 years old. And it was a horrendous birth. I mean, I did a great job. Personally, I think I did a fabulous job because it was back in the days, like just say no to drugs. So it was completely unmedicated. But the doctors were still in the old school of strapping people down. You know, that whole, my legs were strapped down. My hands were strapped down. It was just the most degrading experience. I did a great job. I've had my baby. I think I had active labor and delivery. I think it was 4 hours total with my first baby, and he was 9 pounds. But I was so furious afterwards with what happened. And I write about this in my book, is that I actually got up and walked out of the hospital with my baby at 3 a.m. I was just, that's how mad I was. And so I really wanted to help women have a better experience than I'd had. And so there was an old country doctor in the next town over from where I was in New Hampshire. And so I approached him to see if I could tag along with him. And he said no one had ever asked him that before. And so he and I ran around the countryside catching babies. He was a great teacher. He was very patient. He actually was trained by Joseph DeLee in Chicago. So it's kind of ironic that I think that Joseph DeLee, I'm like the product of Joseph DeLee. He would have lost his mind about that. But anyway, that's what propelled me. And then I got very involved with legislation in New Hampshire to make midwifery be recognized, because of course, a lot of doctors were threatening to throw me in jail. to say I was practicing medicine without a license. And so I worked with the state of New Hampshire and DHHS to design a midwifery program, which all of this is in my book, but we got it passed in 1982. And that was sort of consecutive with the beginning of MANA, the Midwives Alliance of North America, which I'll go on about that in a little bit. So I was the second president of MANA back in the day. And so we got our legislation not only in our state, but also nationally recognized. And then we went to the International Confederation of Midwives in Sydney, Australia, and we got accepted into the ICM in 1985. And I was there for that. So did a lot of the sort of behind the scenes legislation licensing of midwives, just so that there was a avenue to be able to be recognized and not to be tormented about being arrested all the time.
Yeah, that's scary. And the birth stories I've heard, like you're talking about, is horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so they were, the doctors were trained back. I saw a teaching movie once. It was filmed in 1955. So when women were on scopolamine, which was, you know, pretty standard back in those days, they really did have to be strapped down because they were completely out of their minds. It was an amnesiac. Well, scopolamine is a close cousin to LSD. So the women were slamming their heads around. And so they had to put football helmets on the women and strap them down. And the women, when they came to, they were so hoarse from screaming and they didn't realize why they had all these black and blue eyes. And, you know, it was a nightmare. So when women started not being medicated, the doctors were still behaving as though the women needed to be restrained like a wild animal. That's how I felt. I mean, birth is such a sacred moment, and to have your baby come in like that is just, I mean, I couldn't even pick him up. I mean, I couldn't even, my hands were strapped down. So I wanted to help and make sure that other women didn't have to have that experience. And it is better now than it was, but I don't know, there still could be a lot of improvement for sure.
And I cannot imagine how much more painful it was to not be able to move, just lay there.
Right? I know, flat on your back. Like you really were literally flat on your back with your legs up in these metal stirrups, which were strapped. And you're trying to push, I'm trying to push a 9-pound baby like uphill. Even just physiologically, it made absolutely no sense whatsoever, but nobody thought about that. I mean, it was just mm-hmm. The way they'd been trained, you know, automatic episiotomy, and was, so when I first saw my first home birth with Dr. Brown, I couldn't believe how sacred it was. I mean, it was just quiet and gentle and beautiful. I mean, I was weeping with how sacred it was. And that's the way it was meant. I mean, all of a sudden I got, yes, this is the way it's supposed to be.
Did you feel sadness that that was taken from you?
Sadness is a nice word. I would say I was pissed off beyond all belief, but yes, of course. And then I had, you know, conversations with my mother. And she, you know, she had 4 children, all completely knocked out. So when she went to her first home birth, it was one of my cousins, with me, and she was weeping because she realized that she had been denied that for 4 times, you know, that she had been denied that. And I don't know, it's just, we have gotten better, but even now the infant mortality rate and maternal mortality rate is horrendous. I mean, we haven't really done the work that as our medical profession hasn't really done the work that they should be doing.
Yeah. That makes me emotional to feel those feelings that you and all the women that saw birth and what was taken from them.
Well, that's what spawned the whole, you know, just say no to drugs. That's kind of funny that we would say that because we're children of the 60s, but in the 70s, that's what spawned it. It's because women were realizing that they were being, you know, denied this experience. And so that actually was the beginning of the home birth movement, because when you went into the hospital, you still had all this rote stuff. You had an enema, you had routine episiotomy, you had a routine shot of you know, just the whole thing was rote. And so when we realized, why are we going to the hospital if we don't want drugs and we're getting all this medical procedures foisted on us? And so that's when people started staying home. They just said, we're not going to go. We don't want to deal with that. We don't want to have, I mean, I made a list of 55 things that needed to change in my local hospital. And the chief of OB service at that time said, nope, there's no way, there's no way, there's no way. But actually the women forced it. The women stopped going to the hospital. They just said, no, we're staying out. And so in order for their, you know, for their maternity services to survive, they did have to make those changes. And they did have to start, you know, doing the deliveries in the labor bed, and where the woman could stay in the labor bed, and we run them down the hall and on a gurney into the delivery room to get on a metal table. So once they started doing the quote, you know, labor birth and recovery, then women started coming back, kind of. But, you know, there was always a lot of tension between the midwives that were, you know, the women that were staying out. Well, there still is. I mean, there really still is.
Yeah. So did you stayed in that area for your career?
I did. But I covered, I went all over New Hampshire. And then I had a partner. I think after a few years in, I got a really great midwifery partner. And so we were partnered for a long, long, long time. And we did, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of births. And we trained a bunch of apprentices. And New Hampshire actually was really good about their midwives. I mean, the legislation that they passed was fabulous. I worked really hard. And then I don't know what year it was. I had a birth center back then. They made a midwifery board of midwifery, which was the first ever independent midwifery board in the United States, where the midwives, you know, I was the first chair of the board, and we had a pediatrician and an obstetrician on the board, but we were completely independent, just like the board of nursing or the board of obstetric of medicine. And we still have that board actually. In New Hampshire. So that was a really great thing to be able to license our own midwives and take care of all the aspects of it and not have to be, you know, thrown under the bus a gazillion times while we're trying to practice. So that was, yeah, it was great.
Do you know if any other states have a board of midwifery?
I think the only other one is Oregon. I think Oregon had got one pretty soon after we had ours, but I think Vermont might have one too. But usually they put it in, you know, with other boards, which isn't ideal. And because usually it's someone who doesn't really understand. So when we were doing our scope of practice, we had a lot of input, but we were the ones who were able to ultimately say, this is going to be our scope of practice. And you can still look it up. The scope of practice for midwifery in New Hampshire legislation is the MID 500s. And it's right there. And it's great. The whole thing, I think, is a work of art, if I do say so myself.
Well, it's nice to have that clear definition and guidelines when there's questions.
Yeah,
especially as a new midwife, too.
Well, I mean, to keep it safe, you know, for out of, I mean, there's a lot, you know, risking out. So in statute in New Hampshire, we can't do breaches and we can't do twins, but we did get VBACs. That was kind of a struggle with ACOG, but we did get VBACs. So I think, you know, keeps it safe. I mean, New Hampshire statistics are really good. Otherwise you'd be hearing about it. So, yeah, it was quite a journey from being a hippie late midwife running around in the woods with Dr. Brown to, you know, being suited up and going to the ICM in Sydney, Australia to get into the World Health Organization. I mean, the International Confederation of Midwives. So, and then when I was in Moscow, the first baby I delivered was filmed. And it was on 2020 with Barbara Walters, supposedly the first, like I said, the first baby delivered by an American. So that was pretty fun. That was pretty neat.
How did that happen? How did you end up there?
There was a group. So this is back in the 1990s when there was a group in the United States. It was actually out of Woodstock of New York. They wanted to create a joint Soviet US health center. It was sort of, that was a thing back then where they were doing joint stuff. And so they just asked me, and I went with another midwife, Karen Pardini, and it was a pretty intense experience, I have to say. But that baby, the first baby that I delivered, and it was filmed, and you can still see it. It's if you on YouTube, if you look up an American midwife in Moscow, and you can, it's there. The birth is there, the whole thing. So it's, but that baby that I caught in the first one, the mother wanted me to name it the baby, so I named it Mylan after my son. And 14 years later, oh shoot, what happened? I just did something. Oh crap. Okay. So 14 years after I caught that baby in Moscow, my phone rang and I heard all this. I was all garbled and I thought it was just a scammer. But then I heard someone going, Das Vidanya, Das Vidanya. And it was the baby. It was the kid that I had caught in Moscow. He was 14 and he had been taking English in school so that he could call me and talk to me. Oh. I just thought that was so, that was pretty, it was really pretty neat. Really pretty neat.
So sweet.
Yeah, it was fun.
How long did you hang out there?
Well, I was only there for about a month, and it was really kind of an upsetting, they were drugging women with propofol, which was the drug that Michael Jackson died from. All the women were completely knocked out, and it was a pretty much the old operating theater, you know, the operating room kind of deliveries. And it was, yeah, there was no organic kind of home birth stuff happening at all. But I think we made a difference because the women that we help attended, and they really wanted us to show them. So we told them not to drug them, not to give them any drugs. And they said, well, but so those women were able to nurse right away once their babies were born, and all the doctors were crying because they had never seen a baby nurse like right after it was born, because they were also narcotized from the babies were also floppy. I mean, a lot of them had to go for, you know, into the NICU for days. It just, yeah, it was kind of a, and I don't know how much of a impact we had, but I know that midwives started going after that. So I mean, but I think it's still pretty bad. I think I don't know if it made a huge impact.
I wonder if those doctors just like literally didn't know any other way. They just didn't even know there was another way.
Yeah, well, so if you watch this, if you go to that YouTube, an American midwife in Moscow, you can see the doc. We interviewed a lot of doctors, or they interviewed, the 2020 interviewed a lot of doctors, and so they were just like, this is not the way it's done. But then when they saw it, they were like, oh, you know, the babies are alert and aware when they're born. They're not all floppy and blue, you know. So it was just, yeah, I think there was some progress with what we did. I hope
I would anyway. Think there would have to be just right. To have them see something like that. How can you not be affected by that?
Right. Okay. To get it. I think they did get it when they, because their thing was like, once you are fully dilated, they wanted to get the babies out in 10 minutes. And part of it was because of the amount of drugs that the women had, and I think, and oxytocin too, they were all induced. So it wasn't, they did have to get the baby out relatively fast because they were all in fetal distress. So they wanted me to cut it. They did unilateral episiotomies too. They wanted me to cut an episiotomy to get this baby out quickly. So my partner, Karen, started pulling, we brought all our own equipment. And so she started pulling disposable stuff out of her birth bags. And so all the doctors were like, oh, because they'd never seen like Pampers and, you know, so they're all over there, and Karen's doing like this magic tricks of pulling the rabbit out of the hat to just distract them. And so they're all over. And so I never cut an episiotomy because they stopped paying attention. And then the baby slid out and then they all came running back. It was kind of like a comedy, you know, it was a really a great experience. If you see this video, the YouTube, because the mother's face She looked so ecstatic. I mean, she was just ecstatic that she'd had this baby without any drugs and gently, and the baby was, I mean, she just, because all the women had heard horror stories about going into, they call them rodoms, which is the birth houses. And she was ecstatic that she hadn't had that experience. It was really very cool. It was really, really very cool.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to watch that. She probably tells that story to this day.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got one of my interpreters over there. I actually ran into her. We got reunited on Facebook, and she said she was going to look for this woman. I remember her name. And so she was going to look to see if she could find him. That would be really neat.
Yeah, that would be exciting. So tell me some more about your career. You work there. You were very involved in kind of the administrative political side of things.
Do you want me to read a couple of stories now
yeah.
or not?
Yeah,
okay.
Go for it.
Okay, so I had, I've just marked out a couple of.
Perfect.
So my book, this is actually a second book that this story is in, but I didn't write this one in my first book, but this is one of my, because it happened after my first book. So this story is called Baby Sam. I had been asked to be a guest speaker at the University of New Hampshire's nursing course, Making Babies. This is a wildly popular class, probably due to the number of topics that explore sexuality. The current class was huge, about 250 students, and they were all present on this day before the Christmas break because they were getting double extra credit just for showing up. Most of them were texting during my lecture, which I found to be unspeakably rude, but I guess that's just my Luddite age showing. I pressed on with my spiel about the history of midwifery in New Hampshire and in the U.S., trying my best to ignore the glare of smartphones illuminating the kids' faces. As I was packing up to leave, a very smiley young man came bounding up to the podium and handed me a white envelope. He was adorable in that scruffy, rumpled hipster look. God, I really am showing my age. He was grinning from ear to ear. In the envelope was a photo of me, 20 years younger, holding a tightly swaddled newborn. I have a very distinct look of triumph on my face. The young man gave me a huge bear hug and said, "That's me. My name is Sam Carpenter, and you delivered me when I was born. I don't know if you remember my birth or not, but I wanted to give you this picture of us." I looked at him with his impish smile and his t-shirt and thrift store black suit coat, and I said, "Oh, yes, I remember your birth, all right. How could I forget?" I wondered how much he knew. I had delivered Sam's older brother, Nick, 12 years prior to Sam's birth. His parents were lovely people. His father, Bud, was a farrier, and his mother, Jane, was a rodeo queen. She gave birth to Nick in the winter of 1981. Jane was a quiet, strong, no-nonsense woman, and Nick's birth was just as straightforward. It was a pleasure to be there with him, and I got a year's worth of free shoeing of my horse in the bargain. Baby Nick grew into a strong and quiet young man. Apparently, Nick had a gift with horses in his own right and was becoming locally known for his ability to break and train green horses for riding. He was learning to become a farrier like his dad. When Nick was 12 years old, he and a group of friends were swimming in Northwood Lake. Their mothers were standing knee-deep in water on the shore, chatting and sharing neighborhood gossip, when a drunken motorboater from Massachusetts came speeding too close to shore. Jane watched in horror as the speedboat plowed into the swimming kids, killing Nick instantly with the propeller. When I heard of Nick's death, it seemed intolerable to me. My heart was breaking for Jane and Bud. The pain of losing a child was inconceivable to me, a grief too deep to comprehend. I felt as though I had bonded with Nick. As his midwife and the first to greet him at birth, I was forever connected to this child. And now I could only envision too well the long and impossibly slow road of healing that was ahead for his parents. What Jane didn't know at the moment she was standing on the shore, witnessing her son's tragic end, was that she was, unexpectedly, 1 month pregnant. The shock of this realization registered only mildly, as Jane was so engulfed in her grieving and mourning for Nick, she couldn't shift her focus. It was too soon. And as the weeks and months passed, it would continue to be too soon. As her pregnancy progressed, Jane asked me if I would again be her midwife. She felt that I could relate to what she was experiencing, as my late husband had also died in a violent manner only a few years earlier. I was only too familiar with death and the grieving process. we did a lot of grieving together. And truthfully, going through the pregnancy with Jane was incredibly healing for me. We pushed on together through our pain. The steps and stages of grieving can be painfully slow. And instead of abating, Jane's sadness seemed to increase along with her pregnancy. She was a stoic and wonderful woman, but toward term, Jane's family and friends were concerned that she was not acknowledging the child she was carrying, that her emotions were too deluged with loving thoughts and memories of Nick. I personally thought she was doing a remarkable job of holding up considering the circumstances, but I did feel it was time for Jane to shift her attention toward the new baby, at least a little bit. During a prenatal visit a couple weeks before her due date, I led Jane in a guided visualization to help her bond with her baby. Through guided imagery, Jane tried hard to acknowledge the child within, but although she was very appreciative, she found she still couldn't make the shift. In her lingering grief, she simply could not fully embrace this new life. Jane went into labor soon after that visit. Driving to her home, I thought, either this is going to go really well or it's going to be really, really bad. Their house was a converted Shaker schoolhouse that they had renovated into a stunningly beautiful home. When I arrived, it was Jane and Bud and Jane's sister. The three of them were sitting on the bed quietly waiting. Jane was obviously in very active labor, but she never did fuss much. I sat at the end of the bed and observed the laboring trio. Bud held Jane, and then Jane's sister started singing to her. Her sister's voice was so clear and true, it sounded like a flute. She sang to her sister without stopping for 2 hours, a haunting, loving melody. She literally sang the baby out. As Jane's sister sang to her with all her soul, Bud cradled her in his arms, and Jane pushed her new baby out into the world. I received the baby and handed it up to his parents. Jane's reaction to her new child was astonishing. At first, she stared at him in shock, as though in complete disbelief and surprise at his presence. Then she acknowledged him and integrated his being. She gathered him to her tightly and began weeping tears of sorrow and also of the greatest joy. 2 decades later, Jane would say to me, "I think Sam saved my life." I was crying as well. It was a holy moment, and I was deeply thankful to be able to witness such a miracle. Jane had worked so hard through grief and pain, and now baby Sam was here and her life was to begin anew. I sat back and watched their meeting unfold. I think my eyes were transfixed by the candlelight because I swear I could see a soft white glow like a halo around all four of them. My tears were from a boundless love of this sacred moment, the entering of a new life. Now, as my reverie ends, I look at this wonderful, exuberant kid, so friendly and engaging, with his mop of dark hair and the requisite 2-day-old stubble of beard on his smiling face. I say again, "Oh, Sam, I certainly do remember your birth." He grins and tells me that he plans to become an art teacher in high school and a farrier in the summer. Our picture is taken in front of the classroom blackboard. He gives me one last hug before we say goodbye. Sam says, "I told my roommate as I was leaving for class today that I was going to meet the first woman who touched me. My heart is melting."
That is so sweet.
And thank you.
Very powerful.
Thank you.
Okay. That was a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Yeah. I definitely was feeling the emotions on that one. Did you have a second story you were going to share?
I did. I had, this is another birth, another kind of beautiful birth like that. And then I had one for kind of the student, you said there were student midwives or midwife women who were considering becoming a midwife.
Yes, that's a lot of who listens to this.
Okay. All right. This is another kind of, you know, fraught birth, but this is called a beautiful birth. A vast majority of births are sweet, sensual, powerful, and completely uncomplicated. Sandra's birth story is perhaps the most poignant and touching. Sandra is a wonderful, strong African-American woman with a very large smile, close-cropped hair, and gorgeous dark skin. She calls me late in pregnancy and asks if I will attend her at home, even though her baby is going to die. She explains that she had an ultrasound done in her first trimester, and her obstetricians told her that her baby is anencephalic. They have found that the baby has a gross congenital malformation. The skull covering and part of the brain has failed to develop. This condition is fatal and the baby isn't expected to live for more than a short while. Her OBs are encouraging her to abort the baby, but Sandra finds that she simply cannot. Toward the end of her pregnancy, she becomes concerned. She wants to ensure that her baby's condition at birth be treated with dignity and respect until it dies. She doesn't want any heroics or life support to be administered by the hospital. She doesn't want her baby taken away from her. The more she dwells on this, the more she wants her baby to be born and to die at home in the peace and love of its own family. So she calls me. At this time, home birth is rapidly gaining popularity in New Hampshire and is attracting media attention. My response to Sandra's request is that I don't think we can afford the negative press that I know a newborn death at home will generate. Even though we would all know the cause of death, a congenital anomaly, I believe the media will sensationalize it and treat it as if it were the result of a terrible mistake. I decline Sandra gently, saying I'm afraid the adverse publicity could possibly jeopardize other women's freedom to choose their place of birth. Sandra calls me again on our due date and invites me to lunch. We meet at the Nook in Henniker, and she pleads with me forcefully. She explains with heart-wrenching passion how important it is to her family that their baby is allowed to die gracefully at home, surrounded only by loved ones. She fears that in the hospital, the baby might be treated like a freak. Her fervor is undeniable. I feel that I would be doing her a terrible disservice by refusing her. I commit to attend her birth and to deal with the fallout later on. 2 days later, Sandra calls before dawn to say her water has broken. It's a brutally cold day. Even with the rising sun sparkling on the snow, it is well below zero. I feel my nostrils freeze together as I walk. I fairly drag my birth bag down the half-mile snow trail to her cabin at Chipmunk Falls on Craney Hill. I have a heavy heart, and for the first time, I'm really dreading this birth. I realize I am frankly scared. Their little cabin in the clearing looks so cozy with wood smoke curling from the chimney. For some reason, all of Sandra's ducks are perched on the frozen window boxes, looking in the windows. I've heard that animals are irresistibly drawn to birth, but ducks? When I knock on the door, Sandra's 13-year-old daughter, Julie, answers. She's excited. She says her mom feels like she has to push. I quickly quiet myself. I tell Sandra that I would like to check to make sure there isn't any cervix left before she starts pushing. My heart is pounding. I don't know what to expect. Francis has said there's a good possibility of a face presentation with this condition. He has described to me how this will feel when examining, but instead, what I do feel makes my mouth drop open and my heart skip a few beats. My fingers search around. I feel a hard parietal plate, sagittal suture, the posterior fontanelle, a completely normal skull covering. I don't say anything at the moment because I want to be absolutely sure of my discovery. I give Sandra the green light. She begins pushing tentatively. She's gazing into her partner Henry's eyes. He says softly, "It's time to let go now, Sandra." Sandra is grimacing now with her pushes. The head is coming down fast. What is visible looks completely normal to me, a fine-looking head covered with dark black curly hair. I start to laugh and cry at the same time. When the head is crowning, I am positive that the baby is perfect. I say, "Sandra, give me your hand." I take her hand and place it on her baby's emerging head. She feels around reluctantly for a moment. Then the realization spreads across her face like the end of an eclipse. Her expression is unbelievable, a look of pure joy. I am flat out bawling now, trying to see to protect the perineum through a rain of tears. Sandra whispers softly, "My baby." With tears streaming down her face, she reaches down, and with both hands, Sandra delivers her own baby girl. She gathers her up in her arms and holds her daughter close to her heart. Henry looks at his baby in disbelief. He has steeled himself for a grossly disfigured child, not this healthy mocha chocolate cherub who is now studying him intently. He looks at me in questioning shock. I nod with a soggy smile. Henry crumples in gasping sobs. Oh my God, the baby is beautiful. Big sister Julie is nestled at Sandra's side. She's gently stroking her sister's head, looking very confused. Does this mean my sister's going to live? That she's going to be okay? I insert my finger into baby Aurora's mouth to check for suck reflex. She chomps down voraciously on my poor digit. I grin at Julie. Yep, apparently so. This baby looks like a keeper to me. Sandra is stroking her daughter's face, making a haunting sound that is a remarkable cross between a whimper and a coo. Aurora latches onto the breast as though starving. There are four deliriously happy people in that sunny room, thankful for a wonderful new life beginning. I drive home from that birth feeling incredibly happy. I am also thankful for Sandra's strength and intuitive sense that bonded her with her child within's well-being and unconscious knowing that all was well. I'm more than a little awed. Later, when Sandra and I meet for her postpartum checkup, she's understandably furious at the ordeal she went through. Her attitude was so much for the wonders of modern technology. She firmly believes that she was pressured to abort her child simply because she's a Black, unmarried woman in rural New Hampshire who already had a child with a congenital defect. Julie had been born with a serious heart anomaly that had been surgically corrected. Sandra subsequently becomes very active in the area of women's reproductive freedom, vigilantly insisting that women be given correct information about their bodies and the right to choose their own destinies. So that was in 19, hold on, that was in, oh shoot, what year? Okay, so that was in 1976. And ultrasounds back then were, you know, they were they were ridiculous. They were horrible. So I don't know, I can't really say that the doctors did that deliberately, but they probably didn't have, you know, very good ultrasound to be able to predict that it would be anencephalic. I think that that's what happened, but they, anyway, I guess.
Okay, well, I'm glad I was on mute because I was over here sniffling and...
I know. I really have a bunch of stories in here. They're very funny too, by the way. I mean, I don't, it's not all like, it's, there's some really funny ones in here, but I just, I don't know. Those are the ones I picked out.
Yeah, that was very powerful. Did you ever see her again later?
Yeah, she actually, she just died this past winter. So her, both her daughters are Facebook friends of mine. I see one of her daughters like every day, you know. So that's been kind of cool. And the woman died, she had cancer. So the father died, many years ago from cancer, and then the mother just died. She was a beautiful, you know, just a beautiful woman. I am in touch with the two daughters quite a bit.
I'm sure they're very proud of their mother.
Yeah. Yeah. So my last
I'm gonna
one
have to read your book. And I don't have to cry on audio.
All right, this one is for the student midwives. It's called the Red Canvas Drug Bag. Paranoia. It was sheer unadulterated paranoia that caused me to create the infamous drug bag in the first place. Back in the 1970s, when I was a brand new lay midwife in New Hampshire, a midwife in Santa Cruz, California, Kate Bolin, was arrested for having Pitocin in her possession. Several years later, at one of the first board meetings of MANA, Midwives Alliance of North America, in Los Angeles, I had the great fortune of sleeping with Kate Bolin at the conference. It was memorable because Kate had just taken her ACNM boards, and so she had hives. Because I was practicing in a, quote, illegal state, in that New Hampshire's laws about attending childbirth were a gray area at best, there was always the perceived threat of being arrested for practicing medicine without a license. Therefore, I had a little zippered red canvas LL Bean bag on the outside pocket of which I cleverly wrote the words meds in black permanent marker. Yeah, that'll fool them. I put all of my drugs in that little bag, Pitocin, Methogen, Ergotrape, Lidocaine, etc., and all the drug paraphernalia that went with them. I instructed the women who were assisting me at the time that if it looked like we were encountering trouble with the law, they were to throw the secret red bag out the window and feign innocence. Thankfully, it turned out we never had to jettison our drug bag. But we dragged that little red bag around to birth for years until we finally got certified to practice midwifery legally in 1982. Now we had a formulary of specific obstetrics drugs that we could, quote, obtain and administer according to state statute. So I eventually lost track of that little butt-saving little drug bag. After all the political and legal struggles, we midwives were moving on to greater and greater legitimacy. Forward 38 years later, spring 2014. This past winter, a young woman who I had had the deep honor of attending when she was born asked me if I would be present for the birth of her first child. She, Avalon, said it would mean the world to her if I would attend her. I had retired from active practice, but I said I would be delighted to hang out with the new youngsters, the newly licensed New Hampshire midwives who own the Concord Birth Center. I was proud of these young midwives. They were direct descendants from apprentices I had trained back in the day. This gave me tremendous pleasure. I was called to Avalon's birth in the middle of the night. What else? Avalon was quite possibly one of the most beautiful pregnant women I had ever seen. Broad-shouldered, thin hip, round hot belly with a long dark braid casually snaking down her back, an enormously sensual woman. Now she was laboring fiercely in the birth pool at the birth center. Candles were flickering all along the perimeter of the pool. I became mesmerized as I observed Avalon floating and twisting and adjusting her position to better accommodate her descending child. Such a blessed primal scene. Now Avalon's sounds became deeper and her groans more insistent. I could see the head beginning to bulge the perineum. The young midwife in attendance rose from her crouched position beside the pool and leaned over the edge to assist the birth of the head. I felt the young midwife tense as she waited. I placed my hand on the small of her back and started gently rubbing her back. I felt her melt into my hand and all signs of tension relaxed and released. Within minutes, a baby girl slid gently and silently into the midwife's and then the mother's hands. Avalon brought her baby to the surface and kissed her daughter behind her ears. She looked up triumphantly and smiled and said, "Her name is Poppy." The room remained intensely silent and sacred. It was hypnotic watching Avalon and her man quietly greeting their babe in the soft candlelight. I was transfixed. That's when I saw it. There, sitting ever at the ready, was a very familiar sight. On the chair rail ledge behind the birth pool was a red canvas drug bag. I couldn't believe my eyes. The word meds was very faded now. How many hands had held that bag, and in what circumstances? What circuitous route did it take to get here in this place and time? How many lives had it saved? It must have been passed down from apprentice to apprentice to apprentice. I started to tear up when I thought of how far we've come from those paranoid early days when we risked jail and our freedom and the struggles and victories that we had experienced in the past 38 years. The irony was now was the red canvas drug bag was sitting idly by the beautiful state-of-the-art, state-licensed birthing facility where the midwives were legal, licensed, and well-educated and still giving extraordinary quality care. But now these midwives are supported politically, economically, and socially. We, quote, mothers of the revolution, paved the way for them through our joys and sorrows, our failures and our proud successes. We taught them the art and science of our sacred trade. But this new generation, these young midwives, have accomplished even more. They have integrated their profession with modern medicine, ancient wisdom, and spiritual practice. Yes, we truly have come a long way, baby. Of course, at this particular moment, the young midwives had no idea about the history of the meds bag, so I just sat there quietly weeping and grinning deliriously, talking like a lunatic to a nondescript red canvas bag.
I really like how you told that story and it made it come full circle.
Thank you.
That was very beautiful. I like how you midwifed the midwife too.
And thank you.
That was, yeah. Very needed. I just am always in awe of midwives like yourself that have really been true trailblazers to those of us that practice today and went through, I mean, like that, like you have to support women, but also you're in fear of what could happen to you. That's awful.
Yeah, I had a doctor one in the early days screaming at me and threatening to have me thrown in jail and when is this podcast going to air? Do you know?
Probably today or tomorrow. Probably tomorrow.
Oh, okay, great. So I have an announcement. Are you familiar with the Midwives Alliance of North America?
Uh huh.
Man.
Yes.
And so MANA just dissolved on yes. March 1st. And so on April 7th, we're having a memorial service, I guess you want to call it, for MANA. And it's going to be across the country. Do you know about this?
No.
Okay. So this will be good because you can make this announcement.
Yeah.
So it's going to be via Zoom. And I think they're planning, they're getting a Zoom platform through some university somewhere. So it can have like 1,000 people. And it's going to start at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. So that's my group. So we're going to start at 1:00 and then at 2 o'clock, it'll go to the next time zone, 3 o'clock, the next time zone, 4 o'clock on, it'll end on the Pacific West Coast. So you can either sign in for, you know, for all 4 hours, or you can just go for your particular time zone, because there'll be people in your time zone who are setting up the ceremony, the probably midwives that you know in your time zone. But there's going to be an announcement, and there'll be a way to sign up on the Zoom link before Sunday, April 7th.
Yeah, that's good. I'll definitely share that as well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
I'm heartbroken, actually. You know, we worked so hard to, in the early days of MANA, it was wild. It was wonderful. I mean, it was just such a woman affirming. It was, the conferences were fabulous. And it was just, you know, when we all first met, it was just love at first sight. I mean, we just all, but the very first conference, which was not a MANA conference yet, it was in 1976. Sherry Daniels in El Paso, Texas, did the first international conference for midwives. So none of us had, so we all met in El Paso, and there was 150 of us. And we just all fell in love because we realized we were all doing the same thing at the same time. It was sort of just like osmosis. I mean, it was just, so it was really, it was just such a wonderful joy to find your sisters, you know, that were doing the same thing. And so that was the MANA, the basis of MANA. MANA was legally created in 1982. But it was wonderful. It did incredible work to get the profession of midwifery back resurrected, because, you know, the profession of midwifery was dead prior to the mid 70s. I mean, so MANA did a lot, and the ACNM did a lot to resurrect the profession. I'm not sure, because, you know, I retired. I mean, I'm really ancient now. So I just live up in a beaver swamp in Maine now. So I'm not sure exactly what caused the demise of MANA, but I think part of it was apathy, for one. And I really don't know exactly what happened, but it's gone. But hopefully there'll be something that the young midwives will bring something forward. That'll be a new organization to celebrate and make sure that midwives are strong again to keep going. I feel very strongly that there will be something that will come and take its place.
I think so too, because the momentum is, I mean, it seems, what you all have started is just, I think so too. Nobody's going to let that fall, but it is a loss of something epic that was a huge part of your history.
Yeah. It's very sad. And so, but it's sort of interesting now, very heady, all the midwives, us that are working on it now, it's like, some of these people I haven't talked to in decades, you know, and we're all working on it. We're all together. There's a whole bunch of us that are putting it together, and it's, you know, we're going to honor it. We're going to honor MANA for sure.
That's good. That'll be much appreciated. What are you doing with yourself now that you're retired?
I'm sitting in a beaver swamp right now in Maine. We have a 400 acres, a 400 acre wilderness. And I just had a bobcat that came and ate 10 of my chickens. And it's the fattest bobcat you've ever seen in your life. And I'm working with a Maine Master Naturalist program teaching natural history. It's been really great. It's been a blast. And I have a huge greenhouse, and I don't know. I'm just sitting up here in the wilderness watching bobcats.
And sleeping at night.
Yep. That was part of the thing at the end. I had a birth center in New Hampshire, which was great because I could have the student midwives, do all the work, labor coaching. And then it was attached to my house. So when I walk down the hall in my bathroom and catch a baby and then go back to bed. That was really the great,
You're like the attending.
Yeah, the perineal obstetrics. I think that's what they called it. But I mean, at the end, when you get old, you can't stay up all night like you used to be able to, and you just can't do it. Just it gets to be, and that plus I was ready to retire, but I do miss a lot. There's certain parts of it that I do miss, of course, but I'm just walking around in the woods out here, just being a swamp witch.
I mean, it sounds beautiful. Maybe not the bobcat, but.
Yeah, we have my 114 year old cottage that my grandfather built over on the ocean near Acadia National Park. Oh, geez, I just did this again. Oh, crap.
That's okay. Did you tell me you do a podcast?
I haven't done anything up with it in a long time, but I did a podcast with a young woman. It's called Bad Beaver Tales. Bad Beaver Tales, the podcast. Because my last book that I put out is called Bad Beaver Tales, Love and Life in Down East Maine. So I read a bunch of my stories from my new book on that podcast. If some of the players read in the stories, like my mother reads in a couple of stories, and she's 100 now, and she's up here. She's 100 and she's not on one medication. It's crazy.
And she lives right by you.
She does. It's beautiful up here. We have Acadia National Park, which is stunningly gorgeous. I mean, just, and I'm wandering out in the woods making medicine from lichens. That's my new thing. There's two lichens, Usnea and Lobaria pulmonaria they're doing research now. There's probably the strongest antibiotics known to man. And they're hanging from our trees here. We have 400 acres of it. So I've been tincturing that, making medicines for the COVID people. And I don't know, I'm turning into a swamp witch, basically.
Oh, I love it. I feel like you're living like every retired midwife dream, like living in the middle of nowhere, making plant medicine.
Yep. And it's beauty chickens. All around. And we're very lucky. Very, very lucky. And we have a little camp here that it's called Camp Quitchabitchin, which is where we lived before we built our house. My husband's a builder. Our house is just, it's the best house in the world. So yeah, I'm happy. I'm really happy.
It sounds like you've had a very fulfilling career and you're rounding that out with a great post-midwifery retirement.
Yep. Thank you. I am. And I thank you for helping the women who are considering midwifery to have a platform. That's really important.
Because I just said to myself one day, I mean, like, how many times people have asked you, how'd you become a midwife? What do you do? Right? You probably told this story 200 times at least. So I thought we need a place where people can just go and find those stories. And I mean, I'm not obviously the most popular podcast in the world, but it's there and it's people have found it.
Can you send this to me and can I put it on Facebook? Mm-hmm. Because I have like 4,000 followers on Facebook. Yeah. So that would be, a lot of them are midwives or young midwives. So that would be great.
Yeah. And then they can hear a brief version of your story and then they'll say, oh, I have to go buy her book.
Yeah, there we go. A shameless plug.
Yes.
Shameless plug.
Okay. I have people on all the time that they're here to tell their story, but they're also saying, but I'm also doing this now, whatever it is, a business, a side thing, a class, whatever. Yep. And I'm happy to share that because good for them and you for all
great.
That you've done.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's good.
Okay. So your last thing is any words of wisdom. that you would share for somebody that is working on becoming a midwife or wants to become a midwife?
Wow. I think that the most important tool for a midwife that's not really taught is to trust your intuition. I think if you, once you get in sort of entrenched in the wave of whatever it is when birth is happening, I don't mean to have your ego make it be, you know, I'm talking about true intuition, that even if something's bad, that to intuit that this, because I think once you're in that sacred envelope, that you need to trust that what's coming through you is it needs to be listened to. And I'm not talking about ego, like your stuff. Like, I'm talking about the real thing, when you get that feeling, either a good feeling or a bad feeling, that you need to trust it.
Yeah, I think what's hard as a new midwife is
right
overcoming kind of the generalized anxiety or fear.
Yeah.
Before
yeah.
you can reach that point. Do you
yeah
think
and
so?
I think the fear, though, but I mean, there's that's also respect, but I know what
it
you mean
is.
When you sort of, it's respect for the power of it, though. I mean, there's a tremendous, that's why if you have a good teacher who's patient and calm, because it is, yeah, it's intense in the very beginning.
Yes.
It's intense because especially if you're on your own, it's your responsibility. Mm-hmm. And it's a tremendous responsibility. But I think it's also a true respect of the power of it, of what's mm-hmm. happening for, and it's just, so I've been really involved now with death, with the other end of it. And I actually, we just built a boarding room. It's a place for people to be able to come to die. Because I think that's also an important thing, is a good death. And it's very, very similar to birth. It's even the patterns of it, like the transition. And so I think all of that is to stand back and feel there's a tremendous power in death as well. I mean, it's just, it's so similar to birth. It's just breathtaking. It's literally. So I think just to stand in respect and awe of that power, and just help it to unfold the way it's supposed to unfold.
You are not the first midwife to tell me those exact words about death. I cannot remember who it was, but I've interviewed somebody before that was doing something with death in their retired life too.
Yeah, I think
so
it's
really
probably
interesting
a pretty, it makes sense, right? I mean, it's a pretty good transition. So there's a saying I like, so when you die and you're going down that tunnel towards the light, and you keep going down that tunnel towards the light, and you keep going down that tunnel towards the light, and when you get to the light, it's the midwife holding a flashlight. So who knows what happens, but
yeah,
I really
wow.
love that.
That would be ironic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So
yeah.
Yes, that's been my that's my sort of my in my later years, that's my goal, is to help people have a good death.
Yeah, well, that's beautiful. Full circle you have come.
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay. I think that's a good stopping point.
All right. Well, thank you so much for asking me to do this. It was very fun.
Thank you for coming on. It was nice to meet you.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for listening. And I hope you guys will tune in again next time. Remember, you can email me at journeytomidwiferypodcast@gmail.com. And I'm on Facebook and Instagram as Journey to Midwifery Podcast. Send me your suggestions. Or if you'd like to be on the podcast, I would love to hear from you. Until next time.